From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The headlines read like history. Cold War history. NATO ramps up response to Russia. NATO to weigh nuclear threats from Russia. Pentagon chief planning for long-term rift. And mirror image headlines out of Moscow. This is not the Cold War era, but neither is it the peace that came when the Berlin Wall came down. So what's going on? This hour on Point, Cold War shivers in a new day. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you feeling the chill? Is it just theater? What's the right response? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the show, the U.S. and China sit down this week on some tough topics, from man-made islands to cyber attack. But first to, well, we don't want to call it the Russian front. After meeting with Baltic defense troops at the Estonian capital of Tallinn on Tuesday morning, U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced that the U.S. will place military equipment in six former Soviet bloc nations to help reassure NATO allies facing threats from Russia.
We will temporarily stage one armored brigade combat team's vehicles and associated equipment in countries in Central and Eastern Europe. This pre-positioned European activity set includes tanks, infantry fighting vehicles, and artillery.
Speaking alongside Defense Secretary Carter in Tallinn Tuesday, Estonian Defense Minister Sven Mikser, along with other Baltic defense leaders, said they feel threatened by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Mikser and Baltic leaders are eager to accept U.S. military equipment.
We are not talking about entering into a new Cold War type of arms race. We are not trying collectively to match Putin, tank by tank or helicopter by helicopter in the Baltic Sea region either.
On the other hand, the U.S. putting arms out there, Russia talking about arms, talking a lot about nuclear arms. Here was NATO Supreme Allied Commander General Philip Breedlove talking about that and U.S.-NATO exercises in reaction to Russian rhetoric and actions.
Normal and responsible nuclear powers don't act like this, don't talk like this. And for that reason, we find our reason to be out here exercising as we have here.
Joining me first today from Brussels is Naftali Ben-David. He's European correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, just back from NATO headquarters, where he's been covering a gathering of NATO defense ministers. Naftali Ben-David, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Russia has everybody's attention this week. What steps is NATO outlining in response to what's being described as saber-rattling and more from Moscow?
Well, I think in many ways that what we've seen this week is the U.S. and NATO settling in for the long haul and realizing that this is not something that's going to probably go away anytime soon. So, as you mentioned, the U.S. is pre-positioning equipment in Eastern European countries, but NATO is also really bolstering this new spearhead force and a broader rapid response force that it has that's designed to respond quickly if a crisis develops. The main thing is they don't want to be caught unawares as they were when Russia moved into Crimea, and so if another crisis brews, they're going to be able to move very quickly a whole bunch of troops to the area. And that's what they've been doing this week, is working on bolstering that ability.
Would the U.S. equipment that's being sent to Eastern Europe help backstop or equip that spearhead force if it were deployed?
Well, that equipment is really more specifically for U.S. exercises and U.S. training that would be done in conjunction and to help European allies. That's not specifically to help the spearhead force. But there's a whole other set of equipment that is going to help the spearhead force. And the U.S. is very much playing a big role in this. And it's a real sort of transatlantic reaction, if you will, to a lot of what we've been hearing from Russia.
So 250 tanks and more as part of this forward positioning by the U.S. where they have not been before. Let's go to the air. We've had U.S. B-52s in exercises in Latvia, about 180 miles from the Russian border. These, of course, what mainstays of the Cold War arsenal in those days, these would have been could have been nuclear-armed B-52s. What about the Russian flights around Europe? We're hearing about Russian bombers flying without transponders even on, sort of shaking up people in Europe. What's up with that?
Yeah, they've been doing a lot of things that are relatively provocative, and that's been prompting a big response and a lot of complaints from NATO, because we've had occasions where pilots and Russian fighters have been coming really very close, I guess, to NATO aircraft without a lot of warning, and it's really caused a certain amount of panic. And the fear, which is being very explicitly articulated, is that there'll be a miscalculation, there'll be an accident, there'll be some kind of incident that spirals out of control. And I think that's one of the big fears right now, is everybody says they don't want a Cold War, they don't want combat, and I'm sure that that's true as far as it goes, but when there's this kind of hostility and this kind of provocative actions, you know, things can happen that are not necessarily intended by either side.
And then, of course, after the Pentagon talked about forward placement of U.S. military equipment in Eastern Europe, we had Russian President Vladimir Putin announcing Russian plans to deploy nuclear missiles.
More than 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles able to overcome even the most technically advanced anti-missile defense systems will be added to the makeup of the nuclear arsenal this year.
Naftali Ben-David, is this within the bounds of treaties as they stand? Is this a significant or a threatening expansion of nuclear weaponry by Moscow or not?
Well, everybody's trying to figure that out. That is apparently within the bounds of existing treaties. They've been modernizing their force, something that they are allowed to do and wasn't entirely unexpected. But to sort of talk about it in a sort of in-your-face, defiant kind of way is, I think, of concern to Western officials. It's interesting. You have these two complete counter and contradictory narratives going on, because Russia does complain that the West is doing everything it can to encircle them. They're opening new headquarters. They're doing exercises. They're moving troops to countries really on Russia's flank. And NATO says, look, all we're doing is, after Russia has shown itself willing to invade a country, that is to say Ukraine, they need to reassure their allies. So you have these two mirror image narratives essentially going on. And you know, from the West perspective, they're trying to figure out just how to handle Russia. On the one hand, it's not a Cold War adversary the way it used to be. On the other hand, it seems clearly not to be a strategic partner, which is the way they used to think of it just a couple years ago. So this is a fairly delicate decision-making going on right now.
We've got General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, talking, saying, I consider it to be extraordinarily reckless, the way Russia is talking about nuclear weaponry. But as you say, Moscow sees Western troops on its borders. Where does this go? You say NATO is settling in for the long haul. What does that mean? I don't see big increases in their spending, whether in the U.S. or in Europe. There are plenty of other things to spend on. A lot of people don't want to crank up spending. Is that the ultimate indicator of whether we're in a new phase here?
Well, it's true that NATO has really been struggling to get its members to spend more money on defense. You know, because of the economic struggles of recent years, European countries in particular have been cutting defense spending, and that seems to be contradicting the message that NATO is trying to send overall. But it's undeniably true that they've created this new spearhead force, that they're doing a lot more exercising, a lot more patrolling, and that they're pre-positioning equipment, as we've discussed. There's no question that there's a real change in NATO policy. And where does it go? You know, this spearhead force is going to start going into full operation in January. Spain is going to be the first country taking the lead. Then the United Kingdom, the United States is going to be heavily involved. So, I mean, I do think there's this kind of standoff, if you will, that's going to be underway really for the foreseeable future. And we don't know where it's going to go, and that's one of the reasons NATO is acting this way, is precisely because they see Russia as being unpredictable, and so they don't feel like they can rely on what Russia is saying today, and they just feel like they have to be ready for all eventualities.
We may need a new phrase for this period of history, this texture of relationship. Cold War comes to mind. Naftali Ben-David with The Wall Street Journal in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks again for having me.
With me now from Washington is Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies, professor of government foreign service at Georgetown University, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, served as national intelligence officer for Russia in 2004, from 2004 to 2006 at the National Intelligence Council. Just got back from Russia a couple of weeks ago. Angela Stent in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be back on your show, Tom.
And with me in the studio, Dmitry Gorenberg, Russia analyst at CNA. It's a federally funded think tank for the U.S. military. He's associated at the Davis Center for Russia and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. Dmitry Gorenberg, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Angela, when people scratch their heads and ask themselves, are we getting into a new Cold War? You're an expert. What are you thinking?
Well, it sure feels and sounds like it. It's not a Cold War in the way that the old Cold War was. It's not a global military and ideological rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, or now Russia. The U.S. is still militarily much more powerful than Russia. We're not exactly ideological antagonists, although the Russians now put themselves forward as presenting a better model for world governance and society than there is. But what this is a very acute regional rivalry in Russia's backyard. After the Cold War ended, everybody thought that Europe would be at peace and NATO was mainly worried about out-of-area operations. You know, if you go to Europe, they do not believe that their continent's at peace anymore. It's at war. Russia broke treaties. It annexed Crimea. It's heavily involved in the ongoing war in Ukraine, and there's no end in sight for that. So so we're back to the old chestnuts of deterrence and containment. This is why NATO is putting these prepositioning weaponry and a new rapid reaction force. We would like to deter Russia from going any further. We have no idea how far it wants to go. We're very perplexed about how to deal with Russia. And I think my final point in this is, in the old Cold War, there were channels of communication between the United States and Russia that existed, mm-hmm. at the military level, at the political level. Because the situation in Russia, it's a highly personalistic regime, we don't even have those channels of communication anymore, particularly on the military-to-military level. And therefore, in some ways, this is a more dangerous era than it was, at least in the last 10, 15 years of the Cold War.
Dmitry Goenberg, what's the risk of further escalation here?
I think the risk of escalation is highest because of these potential misunderstandings. So I don't think either side really wants further escalation. And I agree completely with Angela in that the miscalculation is where the potential is. And so the key to me is to rebuild some of those channels of communication that used to exist in the Cold War days.
Neither side wants escalation, you say, but does Russia want the Baltics back?
That's the big question, and I'm not sure.
It sounds a little escalatory right there. Dmitry Goenberg, please stand by with me here in the studio. Angela Stent in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Cold War shivers in the U.S.-Russia, NATO-Russia relationship. Taking a look at China, too, before this hour is out. Nobody wants to go back to Cold War or forward to Cold War, but something's going on. We're parsing it with Angela Stent. She is at Georgetown University. Dmitry Goenberg is with me in the studio today. He's a Russia analyst at CNA, think tank that advises the U.S. military. Here's U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry saying that the plans to add more intercontinental ballistic missiles, Moscow's plans, could mean a return to some kind of tension. This is just hours after Russian President Putin made the announcement last week.
We've had enormous cooperation from the 1990s forward with respect to the destruction of nuclear weapons that were in former territories of the Soviet Union. And nobody wants to see us step backwards. Nobody wants to, I think, go back to a kind of Cold War status.
No, but here's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg also denouncing the Putin's plans for 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles. Here's Stoltenberg.
This nuclear saber rattling of Russia is unjustified. It's destabilizing, and it's dangerous.
And here's U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter saying, well, the U.S. has to do something here, but the door to Russia is open.
These are a response to Russia's provocations. Aggressive rhetoric, aggressive behavior, the kind of thing that doesn't belong in a Europe whole and free. We continue to hope that Russia will change course. I don't see any signs of that, quite honestly, right now. But we continue to hold the door open.
So where are we headed? What is this? Angela Stent, Dmitry Goenberg are with us. Dmitry, Angela says this is not Cold War, in part because this is not a global ideological rivalry. Does that matter? If we're at, weapon tips with Russia in Europe, that's a pretty big theater all on its own. How much does it matter if the ideology's been drained out of it and it's not global?
Well, I think the key thing is that to remember that this is the Russia's interests are primarily around its borders. It's not even all of Europe. Mm-hmm. It's the region that used to be the Soviet Union. So, and that's why when you mentioned before the break the Baltic states, that's the key potential flashpoint, because there's Ukraine, there's Central Asia, there's Belarus,
South,
but those are areas where the U.S. and NATO don't have any explicit responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Baltic states, that's where Article 5 comes in.
They are now members of NATO.
And so
Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia.
That's right. And so you end up in a position where there's a possibility of an actual confrontation. Now, I don't think, from my point of view, I don't see Russia doing a sort of a little green men kind of invasion of the Baltic states.
That is boots on the ground, troops over the border.
Yeah. Because they are too worried. They realize that NATO has superiority in conventional arms at the very least, and they don't want to get into that conflict. But what is possible is some kind of political destabilization from inside using sympathizers within the Baltic political system to try to destabilize those countries.
Angela, what about that risk? And if that happens, how would NATO respond? I mean, I'm reading here in the New York Times, Russia's chief of the general staff, this is Valery Gerasimov, General mm-hmm. Gerasimov, in 2013 laid out this, what they call a kind of hybrid warfare style, which is exactly, you don't go over the border with troops, but you destabilize. This is a doctrine that's quoting here, a military means of concealed character, including carrying out actions of informational conflict and actions of special operations forces. Sounds kind of like Ukraine. You would just have a more and more chaotic situation, I guess, in the Baltics if this were pursued. Is NATO prepared for that? How would NATO respond?
Well, I think that's what NATO's trying to respond to this now. I mean, the truth is that when the Baltic states joined NATO in 2004 and they're now part of this Article 5 collective defense, nobody thought that there would really be a possibility of that Russia would attack these countries. And now, as we've seen in the past 18 months and we've looked at what's happened in Ukraine, the Baltic states have become very concerned about this. President Putin has said that there's such a thing as a Russian world and that he has a sacred duty to protect Russian speakers and Russians, ethnic Russians who live outside of Russia itself. And of course, there's a high percentage in Estonia and in Latvia of Russians and Russian-speaking people. So that's an excuse. We've already seen cyber attacks in countries like Estonia. So it doesn't have to be boots on the ground, as Dmitry said. You can have political destabilization. And now, last year, the Russians abducted an Estonian counterintelligence official. Mm-hmm. They somehow got him over the border. He's now in prison in Moscow. He hasn't gone on trial yet. So there are real fears about that. So the Baltic states do feel that they're under threat. And I think what NATO was trying to do is to say now, yes, Article 5 guarantees are real. President Obama went to Estonia last year, and he made that clear. But we'll see how real that is. And I think the Russians are watching for any chink in the armor there, trying to see, is NATO really serious about this? So it's a sort of game of chicken now here, too. But it could be, it's quite dangerous and it could escalate. And I think the Baltic states have some reason to believe that they could be destabilized, even though I agree you're not going to see, I would doubt that you're going to see a Russian conventional attack. The other question is that the Russians have been using this rhetoric about limited nuclear war, the limited use of nuclear weapons, and that's another thing that gets the Baltic states very worried. So NATO now really has to show that Article 5 guarantees are real and that we can defend our allies.
Angela Stent, Dmitry Gorenberg, please stand by. Lots of callers for the two of you. Dominic in Tallahassee, Florida. Dominic, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for accepting my call. I'm old enough to remember when the Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. And I thought George H.W. Bush, Mikhail Gorbachev, had an understanding that the Iron Curtain would come down and the Berlin Wall would fall and the United States would not expand NATO into Eastern Europe. Now, Bill Clinton got elected and he expanded NATO into Poland and Hungary. But George Kennan, the father of our containment policy during the Cold War, mm-hmm. who certainly could not be called an appeaser, predicted that we would have this mess if we expanded NATO into Eastern Europe, much less into the Ukraine.
Dominic, let us look at it. Dimitri, do you see the U.S. and NATO as having overstepped on understandings?
So there's been quite a lot of research on this, and it's shown pretty conclusively that there were no explicit promises to not expand NATO to Eastern Europe. There may have been some implicit conversations that weren't official, but we don't have those records, and we don't. And anything that wasn't codified, obviously, isn't very binding on anyone. Now, having said that, there's a lot to be said for the view that there was a missed opportunity to integrate Russia better into the European security architecture back in the early 90s.
Though it's still formally called a partner in NATO documents.
Well, yeah, yes, although less so now that they've frozen. Yeah.
Angela, what about it? Is this a reaction to Western intrusion, or is this an offensive Russian impulse to rebuild what was?
Tom, no promises were made to the Russians. It wasn't even discussed. So this is a myth that the Russians and people in other parts of the world are trying to perpetuate. Gorbachev himself said recently, no promises were made. There was no discussion of NATO enlargement. This refers back to when Germany was united and there was a treaty signed, and people have misinterpreted what Secretary of State James Baker said. And I don't see why Poland, for instance, having been under Russian domination for hundreds of years, why Poland didn't have the right to join NATO. Now, having said that, you know, I agree with Dimitri. Maybe it would have been possible to create a system in the 90s, a Euro-Atlantic security system in which Russia had a stake. But Russia was a weak country then. We did create a NATO-Russia Permanent Joint Council in 1997. We've tried to include Russia in these discussions. And if you talk to the people in the Clinton administration, they will tell you they made lots of efforts to try and get Russia to buy in, to become a partner in this system, and the Russians weren't interested. There was even a discussion of Russia at some point joining NATO. So I think we have to be very careful not to believe a lot of the propaganda that we hear about this. The West did not break any promises.
Let me go to Pat in Hartford, Wisconsin. Pat, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question really relates to similarities between the current situation in Russia and Germany pre-World War II, in between World War I and World War II. We have the outside world putting huge economic pressure on them. Their economy, as a result, is doing very badly. Putin isn't going to take any responsibility for that. Politically, it would be a disaster for him to do so. So it seems like the situation is really ripe for bashing, blaming basically the situation on a scapegoat and using it as an excuse to grab more power and ramp up military might.
Pat, let us pick it up from a couple of angles. Angela, start in on that. I mean, I don't see people talking about Russia as a rising Nazi Germany in its power potential. Though it's been back on its heels, has felt beleaguered, and I suppose with the economic sanctions especially now set upon.
Well, so this is the Weimar Russia syndrome. Mm. Right now, Putin has, I guess, 89% popularity rate, and a lot of that is based on demonizing the United States and the West and its fifth columnists inside Russia. In other words, the U.S. is trying to destroy Russia. I heard that. I gave a lecture when I was in Moscow a few weeks ago at a pretty prestigious university. I heard that from the students. They seem to believe what they see on television. So we're trying to destroy them, and our agents inside Russia are trying to destroy them.
This is the chatter. This is the perspective. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a perspective. So on the other hand, you know, Russia, as the caller says, it is suffering economically. It was suffering economically before the sanctions because it hasn't reformed its economy. It doesn't have a modern economy. It hasn't done what it said it was going to do and Putin said he was going to do earlier on when he came to power. So it's not a rising power, but it still is a predominant military power in its neighborhood. And Dmitry was already talking about about that. So this is potentially a dangerous combination of factors, and I think one does have to be concerned about it.
Dmitry, what's the ratchet down path here? I mean, we those of us who lived through the Cold War remember the kind of inexorable feeling about it. You just couldn't figure out how to get out of it. And people spent more and more, and they invested more and more. And the risks seemed so towering when nuclear weapons were on the hair trigger and all the rest. Does this have a retreat path built in somewhere that we're not taking advantage of for both sides to climb down?
Honestly, I don't think there is an immediate retreat path. Both sides are too invested in, you know, for Putin, retreat is defeat in a sense.
Mm-hmm. His politics are based in this aggressive posture.
Yeah, and you know, Angela just said he has the 89% approval rating, but there's nothing more fragile than the approval rating of an autocrat. And if, you know, if he did step back, he would lose the nationalists. He's already lost the liberals. It could collapse very quickly. For the West, obviously, we have to show that we're not going to be intimidated and we're not willing to give up these East European countries. So I think the best case is kind of more of what we have now. No further escalation, but I don't – I'm not very optimistic about a decrease in tensions over the next couple of years.
Jim in Kent, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm very concerned about the situation that we're in now. This past Monday, on June 22nd, marked the anniversary of Operation Barbarossa, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. And prior to that, of course, he built up his forces all along the western border with Russia, or the Soviet Union. And to me, it seems to me that history is replaying itself here, except we are taking the role of Hitler as far as our aggressive intentions on Russia. I think it's a very dangerous game that we're playing, and NATO's reason for existence disappeared the day the Warsaw Pact dissolved. We should have dissolved the NATO Pact, the NATO alliance, and then we could have climbed down from there, saved billions and trillions of dollars if we had done that. But instead, what we're doing is we overthrow the government of Ukraine, the legitimate government, put in a fascist puppet like they had in World War II, who's going to welcome the Nazis in, which is us in this case.
Jim, we've got it, though I think a lot of Ukrainians would sharply disagree with you there. Angela, respond, please.
Well, I don't know where to start. Viktor Yanukovych, who was the president of Ukraine, fled. He overthrew himself. We didn't overthrow anyone. Point one. Two, the people who are in power in Kiev are not fascists and they're not neo-Nazis. It's a coalition of people. They're obviously under tremendous strain because their country is at war and it's been invaded. So this is a myth, too. Our actions haven't been aggressive. We're responding to Russian aggression against Ukraine and threatened, you know, the threats to its neighbors. So I'll stop there.
Dmitry, we've got Ukraine, we've got the Baltics, we've got a minute and a half. Both of these look volatile. There's worries about more fighting in Ukraine over the summer. The Baltics, we've got Western exercises there, and as kidnapping, as Angela said already, where should we keep our eyes peeled for the sharpest view of potential further flare-up?
I think we keep your eyes on Ukraine. As long as that conflict is continuing, I don't think Putin is going to want to start another one in the north. The resources are limited. So as long as the Donbas, the eastern Ukraine region, remains volatile and there's potential confrontation there, I think that's going to occupy the main focus for Russia. Now, the problem for Ukraine is that Russia's interests are not served by stabilizing the conflict. They want to keep that conflict going as a lever on central government in Kiev. So that's
a lever, giving them influence, giving Moscow more sway, even without a change
in
government.
Because otherwise, Kiev would, they see, and they're probably right, that Kiev would just ally itself completely with the West, and they wouldn't have any influence there.
We're going to turn and look for a few minutes at China. I want to thank the two of you for joining us today. Dmitry Gorenberg with CNA with me in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in, Dmitry.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Angela Stent at Georgetown University in Washington. Thank you so much, Ms. Stent.
Thanks.
Listeners, we're going to turn to China and talks in Washington this week between the U.S. and China after a period of some tension on that front. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. China is a rising power. The U.S. is the established power. That is always a tricky dynamic. The two need each other. They could also conflict. Tensions lately over the South China Sea and cyber attacks have raised the Cold War question here, too. Quietly, less vividly than in Europe, we want to look at the balance of cooperation and contention in the U.S.-China relationship. The whole world watched the images of the Chinese ships building out islands in the South China Sea. Here was Chinese Admiral Sun Jingguo talking after U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore earlier this month. Interpreted here by CNN, the Chinese admiral saying, no problem.
Regarding the issue of air defense zone in the South China Sea, it will depend on whether our security in the air and maritime will be threatened, and to what extent, and comprehensive factors will be taken into consideration. The situation in the South China Sea has been on the whole peaceful and stable. There is no reason for people to play up this issue in the South China Sea.
No reason to play it up. The Chinese have challenged U.S. military aircraft there. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said the U.S. will be there.
The United States will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, as U.S. forces do all over the world.
And then there's the big dynamic between these two big powers. In May, the Carter Center and the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences held a conference titled China's Reform Opportunities and Challenges. Dr. David Lampton, professor, director of China Studies at Johns Hopkins, very respected in this arena, said the U.S. and China are nearing, in his keynote address, said, are nearing a potentially dangerous watershed.
The tipping point is near. Our respective fears are nearer to outweighing our hopes than at any time since normalization. We're witnessing the erosion of some of the critical underlying supports for predominantly positive U.S.-China ties. Though the foundation is not crumbled, today important components of the American policy elite increasingly are coming to see China as a threat to the primacy of the United States. In China, increasing factions of the elite and public see America as an impediment to China's achieving its rightful international role and that we are not helpful to their maintenance of domestic stability.
So where does this go? Joining me now is Ken Lieberthal, expert in Chinese foreign policy, served as senior director for Asia on the National Security Council from 98 to 2000. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ken Lieberthal, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So this Cold War language is very broad, and there are many differences, and yet, people looking around the world first at Europe, but also the tension seems palpably to have risen with China in the last year. And David, Mike Lampton got a lot of people's attention with his statement there that the tipping point is near. How do you see what's going on in this relationship?
I actually agree with Mike in his analysis that increasingly, there are tensions in part because China has gotten to be the second largest economy in the world. It now has a substantial military, better able to project power into the South China Sea, around Asia, and to some extent beyond Asia. the U.S. itself is, on the one hand, we've always anticipated that China would play a larger role in the world, have encouraged Chinese growth and participation, in the international multilateral institutions. But on the other hand, we haven't really gotten comfortable with the notion that that may impinge on our capacity to shape the way Asia and the world operates. And so what Mike Lampton was saying was we both need to adjust. The Chinese need to make some decisions that will lower tensions, for example, in the South China Sea, and the United States has to recognize that primacy is not domination and that we have to build in a variety of accommodations to avoid a situation that tilts toward Cold War when, as you so rightly pointed out earlier, the Cold War with the Soviet Union was one that imposed huge costs on everyone, and no one could seem to figure out a way to get out of a dangerous and extremely costly situation.
Our friend Evan Osnos at the New Yorker, of course, spent a lot of time in China, quotes a senior official, I guess that means pretty high in the Obama administration, saying, "We are entering a more dangerous era with China, the U.S., in which neither side can afford to misread the other." Where do you see the greatest potential for, the most risky potential for misreading, Ken Lieberthal?
I think actually the question is on long-term intentions. The worry is that the Chinese increasingly are concerned that the U.S., reflecting the underlying issue that you raised at the beginning on China, which is to say China is rising, the U.S. has been the dominant power, there are always dangers with this, that the Chinese may see the U.S. as determined to prevent, complicate China's rise. And the U.S. may see the Chinese determined to move the U.S. out of Asia. Each of us have national leaders who say that is not what our intentions are. But if you have these underlying suspicions, they can drive a lot of assumptions about intentions and produce very dangerous responses to situations as they develop. Each of us, let me add, are working on building. For example, our military-to-military relations now are deeper than they have ever been. We have reached agreement on rules of engagement when incidents at sea occur, and we are near to completing similar rules on aircraft that fly near each other and so forth. So we recognize the danger, but there is that kind of underlying problem that exists.
On the other hand, China looking at building a blue water navy now with a sort of, I guess, some kind of global capacity. And in the South China Sea, we've all seen those trawlers bringing up from the seabed more and more sand and whatever they're stacking up there. And it looks like they're preparing to build airfields or already have some. Do we already have the makings of potential flashpoint right there if the Chinese turns these man-made islands into forward naval positions?
I think the question is what China will put on those man-made islands. We're talking about potentially two or three of these, and these are not huge islands. These are small, but they are big enough. At least one, at least, is big enough for military aircraft. They're very vulnerable militarily, so I don't think that the Chinese are going to use these to put in assets that would actually threaten U.S. capabilities in the region. But it's a matter of how we respond to that and whether we can sit down with the Chinese and make clear in ways both of us are satisfied with that there are some kinds of facilities there that are acceptable. But if the Chinese use that as a basis for then establishing some sort of air defense zone, air identification defense zone, that's going to become a real problem.
And, of course, we heard them call out already to the flight that CNN happened to be on where they said, get out of our airspace. Ash Carter saying, no, we won't. That's not what it is. It's international. Ben in Somerville, South Carolina, you're on, Ben. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. So I'm an 18-year-old, just graduated from high school.
Okay.
And I see a lot of, I don't want to be, offend you guys or anything, but I see a lot of middle-aged people not – it seems like people aren't taking into account how globalized the world really is and how globalized it's going to be when our generation comes up. And how these tensions might not be as serious of a threat as you guys are insinuating they are. Like, it seems like these tensions have been around for decades, and I don't see why. Could you just explain to me why right now is the critical time or a tipping point?
Ben, I'm very glad you bring that perspective, because I'm so tempted to share it, and I'm sure a lot of people are. Ken Lieberthal, we are in a globalized world. We and China, just to name two, we depend on each other so very deeply, it can seem almost absurd to think of conflict, war, Cold War, whatever you want to call it. Ben's giving voice to that and isn't quite buying the kind of concern that we're hearing. Does globalization that we've seen mean that the kind of conflicts that have racked humanity forever are now off the table? If there's a tipping point, walk us through again what that is, from what to what, potentially.
I think the tipping point, first of all, I agree with the caller. And for someone who's 18 years old, you have a historical perspective that is terrific. I hope you end up going into government and doing a lot of good.
Go, Ben, go.
Yeah. As you look around the world today, this is a world in enormous conflict. It's most obvious in the Middle East. There is a lot of chaos in the world. The irony here is we're talking about a tipping point toward Cold War with China or something like that. But it is our relationship with China and Asia more generally that is one of the most stable parts of the world today.
And hopeful. It could be, should be good.
I agree with that. But again, there are concerns about American primacy, about America's ability to shape outcomes that resonate politically in this country. And I think in China, one of the great fears, as Chinese President Xi Jinping thinks about. I think one of his greatest concerns about the United States actually is not our military capabilities in the region and our alliances in the region. It is our potentially taking action to destabilize domestic politics in China.
Taking action where, or just
well,
by
taking
our being?
Action. Well, if there is large-scale domestic unrest in China, because it's a society in enormous transition, there are a lot of tensions in that society. If things should bubble up there, I think the concern is that the U.S. would then, through cyber means and others, encourage the what we will see as the democratic, anti-communist, anti-authoritarian forces. And that's a real concern of his. Whether it's a realistic concern is a different issue. The reality is I think he's very worried about instability in China and sees the U.S. as potentially encouraging that if it gets going.
Well, how far does that go?
By the way, I think that's wrong in that I think that the U.S. government does not think at all in terms of trying to instigate mass unrest in China. I think we would see that as a situation that would be enormously dangerous and not in American interest.
But the United States has been explicitly ideologically opposed to authoritarian government for a long time. It's been pro-democracy for a long time in its posture around the world. I mean, you could say that American values themselves are a challenge to Chinese system of government. China taking steps recently toward clamping down on NGOs in China, non-governmental organizations, including American ones, which in the past were seen as missionaries of freedom or democracy. Does that mean there's a baked-in-the-cake conflict, whether anybody pursues it or not?
I think there is a baked-in-the-cake set of concerns. A set of concerns and worries is far short mm-hmm. of having a Cold War and conflict, and it's the obligation of intelligent leaders to prevent concerns from producing, a slide into worst-case outcomes where everyone loses. My own feeling is if the U.S. is really concerned about the spread of democracy, we are most effective in that by managing our own house well,
yes.
By showing that democracy really works effectively and we protect our own civil liberties and so forth. And I think, frankly, in China, we are widely respected when we do that. But the concern here is that we, in your earlier part of the program, mm-hmm. when you talked about Ukraine, there was a point. I agree completely. We didn't instigate what happened there. We didn't overthrow this corrupt leadership that they had. But we very early on expressed, agreement with the objectives of the people in the Maidan.
Well, was that wrong in the new globalized world? Does the U.S. have to be mute about its views on freedom, human rights?
No, we don't have to be mute about our views on freedom and human rights. But I do think that you have to appreciate that every action you take has consequences. It's seen by others. And so when you evaluate their conduct, you have to do it in terms of how they're seeing what we're trying to do. And so it's simply you can't see it all from just a U.S. perspective, and we're defending universal values, and therefore we ought to encourage freedom fighters everywhere. There are broader and interests that are also extremely important to pay a lot of attention to.
And can be in contention. I mean, that's all right if we all work cool-headedly about it. When it gets hot is when people worry. What about the cyber attack that we saw recently going in over a long period of time into personnel records of the federal government? The U.S. Mm-hmm. government is not formally, but has certainly widely suggested that was China. Do you believe that? And what does that mean about China's intentions?
I think it is very possibly China. I'll leave that up to the technical experts to figure out degree of certainty on it. But let's suppose it was China. Their getting this data is very damaging to our national security. If what they are suggesting was taken turns out to be true. Having said that, should we be condemning the Chinese for using cyber means to get data that we want to keep away from them? We certainly would never give up that right ourselves. No government would give up the right to conduct espionage that does not involve violence and that is aimed at getting secrets that they want to get.
Are we draining China's central government computer banks of their data?
I don't know specifically what we're draining there. I think we're draining everything we can get a hold of. The issue is whether either side engages in sabotage, actually using cyber means to destroy things or cause accidents, cause deaths. That's a different matter. But just espionage, I can't imagine that we would agree to give it up. I can't imagine that they would.
Ken Lieberthal, terrific perspective today. We're very grateful for it. Ken Lieberthal is a senior fellow in foreign policy, global economy, and development at the Brookings Institution. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.